things get a little bit grim.
But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah! That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
Piper, are you gonna say something? Piper, say hi.
Baby me. Baby meows.
I know. So you know how we have nicknames for all, like, the animals ever?
Yeah.
Ryan's nickname for her is Rude Bitch.
That's not a nickname. That's bullying.
She's so mean to you. But she's got a mean meow. She's like, meow.
She does have a little bit of a... She does sound a little gruff.
Yeah.
Come here. Want to snuggle with me? No. Okay, that's cool. I get it.
She does not snuggle. Like, she doesn't just sit on your lap.
Mm-mm.
She won't do that. The only time she wants to snuggle with me is when I'm laying down. And she'll, like, lay on my chest.
Aw.
And we do that every night without fail. But she does not want to just sit on my lap if I'm watching TV or if I'm doing research or anything like that. She's not interested.
I love that for her. And also you. Donut. I took a bath today.
Oh, okay.
Tried to climb onto my chest while I was in the bath.
Donut boy.
It just, he has a, what is it called when you like people too much? What is that? Clingy. When you're clingy.
Oh, I was going to say an extrovert.
No. He is not an extrovert. Codependent, oh, maybe.
Yeah, he's a codependent, anxiety-ridden animal.
Yeah, he is.
For sure.
He is.
Aw, how do you think he's going to do with the move?
He'll be fine, but he does this thing when he's in the car, and I think I've talked about it before,
mm-hmm.
but he drools.
God. Oh,
like, it's so gross. But, like, it will glob out of his mouth.
Oh, my gosh.
You have to wrap him up in a towel and have, like, a towel underneath of him. He'll soak through your shirt if, like, you hold him close to you. You can't put him in a cat carrier.
Uh-huh.
He'll drown
himself in the Titanic.
You have not ever seen anything like it. You know those Beethoven dogs?
Yeah.
He's like that.
Saint Bernard.
Oh my God.
Beethoven dog.
Whatever they
I mean,
are.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. See, you knew.
I got my message crossed.
Oh, it's obscene, honestly.
Oh, poor boy.
I know, but Ian and I picked out a backsplash.
Ooh, what's it look like?
It's obnoxious.
I can't wait to see it.
It's like a swirly whirly, like black, blue, and gray.
Ooh, fun.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's gonna be pretty. Yeah.
I'm not a subway tile kind of gal.
No.
We need something add a little bit of spice.
And then I'm the person in my house that's like, I like white. And I also like a light gray. I can also get down with beige.
So the current homeowner
have
this paint color that is unreal.
Oh, no.
It's whenever you, it doesn't matter where you are in the house, it looks different. The entire house is painted the exact same color. In some places, it is light gray, dark gray, seafoam blue, light blue. There's one room where it looks straight lavender.
Oh, my.
But it is all the same paint color. I don't know what kind of, like, mood ring.
That sounds like the paint that was in my last house, because I painted everything the same color gray.
Yeah.
And it looked lavender upstairs.
Yes.
Like, we bought all this paint on Black Friday, because it was on such a good deal. So we bought 4 or 5 gallon buckets of this paint.
Yeah.
And when I got it on one room, I was like, this is purple.
Oops.
Can I return 20 gallons of
clearance paint?
Of paint?
I doubt that.
I don't think you can. So I was like, well, I guess my whole house is going to be a shade of lavender.
Yeah.
And we ran with it.
It didn't look lavender though, downstairs.
Not downstairs. Upstairs, I really think it did. But yeah, I don't know.
It's wild. So,
I mean,
I'm keeping it. I like it. I like how, like, if the light hits differently, it'll be a different color.
I like that.
Yeah.
And then if you need to do touch up, it's really easy to do because you already know what color it is.
Correct. And they're leaving, like, they have the paint already, uh-huh. so they're leaving it there for us so we can do touch-ups.
Nice. The last people who own this house, they left all of the paint and all of the, like, numbers on it.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice.
So we can go get more if it's...
Did you paint anything?
We painted this room in the basement. So we painted the dark blue up here, and then we painted in my kitchen and my dining room. There were two walls that were burgundy that we painted light blue.
Yes.
Instead of
burgundy. Burgundy was certainly a choice that people...
It was such a 90s, like 2000s choice.
Yeah.
And
it's like rich people 2004.
Yeah. 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 I think that's what we were going for because everything is maple. All of the wood is maple, yes. which I feel like is a very... it was very on brand in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the like nice thing to get.
Yeah.
And it's just... it needed a refresh.
I get it.
And they also left all of their quotes on the walls for me.
Cute.
All of the decals I had to get off. And it was all like, live, laugh, love.
Oh my God.
Praise Christ, thou art, be his name.
Thou art.
I swear.
Oh, you just made some Christians mad.
You're in the wrong part of the internet. My friends.
My friends. Love you lots.
Love
mean
you
it.
So much.
Oh my gosh, that is hysterical.
Well, speaking of... I don't
know. Well...
No. Anyways, today's cults.
Speaking of radicals.
To think long and hard.
That... You really fucking tiptoed around that one, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Oh, it is cults. I was having a thought that I know the rotation is that you are supposed to go first.
Okay.
But Taylor is doing something fancy pants on us here.
I'm doing a 1-2 switcheroo.
I'm doing a 1-2 to be continued.
Yes. So I'm happy to go first if you would like to keep the rotation. Cat feeders.
just see a stampede of cats across the hallway.
I hear it start and I'm like, oh, well.
The pitter-patter of 12 paws.
Oh, gosh. I'm still happy to go first if you want to maintain the rotation, but I think it makes sense for me to go last so that I can start first next time.
Yeah.
But whatever you want to do. I am not married to any idea.
I'm cool with that. I'm proposed to it. I'm affianced to the idea of you going second so you can put yours together.
Okay, perfect.
But I don't want to tell anybody what you're doing, but it is... I'm so excited.
I am also very excited. I'm worried that I did not do it justice.
You will.
I hope.
If anybody could do this cult right, it's you. There's a lot.
It's so much. It's so much. So.
So in, I tried to like be thoughtful about my cult. It's not super long.
Okay.
But boy, is it gross.
Ooh, yay.
Boy, is it gross. And we are a little cult adjacent. Okay. This could also be true crime.
Ooh, okay.
But we're going to stick.
Stick with what it is.
Stick with, because it. Ooh. Hmm. Okay. Are we ready to just jump right into this? This is a heck and doozy. Put on your seat belts, y'all.
All right.
Ready?
I have a funny pun after mine. Don't let me forget, but I stole it from somebody else, so I don't want it to come off like I came up with
like
this
it's
pun.
An original thought.
It's not. I just heard it and could not stop laughing.
Okay. Adolfo Costanzo. Do you know that name?
No.
Okay. Adolfo Costanzo was born in Miami, Florida, Celia Aurora Gonzalez, a Cuban immigrant mother in 1962. She gave birth to Adolfo at the age of 15 and eventually had three children. Dahlia moved to San Juan, Puerto Rico after her first husband died and got remarried there. Costanzo was baptized Catholic and served as an altar boy, but also accompanied his mother on trips to Haiti to learn about voodoo.
Mm.
Both Delia and her mother wore santeras, which are like high priestess in the Santeria religion.
Oh, okay.
Costanzo's family returned to Miami in 1972, and his stepfather died soon after, leaving the family with a bit of an inheritance.
Oh.
As a teenager, he became apprenticed to a local sorcerer.
Oh my gosh.
And began to practice a religion called Palo Mayombe, which is a branch of the Palo religions.
Okay.
Which involves some ritual animal sacrifice. Delia remarried, and his new stepfather was involved both in the Palo religion, and he was also a drug dealer. Costanzo and his mother were arrested numerous times for theft, vandalism, and shoplifting. He graduated from high school, but was expelled from prep school in Miami. His neighbors constantly complained to the city of dead animals being left at their doors after confrontations with them.
Ooh, unfortunate.
Unfortunate indeed. His mother was later arrested for harboring 27 animals in her small apartment, which had floors smeared with blood and feces, according to the Los Angeles Times.
God.
So,
and this is in Miami?
This is in Miami. We're off to a little bit of a rough start here.
Yeah, 27 animals in a small apartment. Blood and feces. That sounds like a really bad recipe.
It is. Spoiler alert. It does not get better. This is the warm, fuzzy part.
Oh, okay. Sharp downhill.
Sharp downhill. Fair-skinned and handsome, Costanzo worked as a male model before moving to Mexico City in 1984. Openly bisexual, Costanzo had multiple male and female lovers who he began recruiting into his cult.
Ooh.
They referred to him as El Padrino, or the Godfather. Among them was a tall, beautiful college student named Sarah Aldrete, who would become his second in command and would eventually be known as La Madrina, the godmother.
This is starting to sound familiar.
Is it?
Now that we're... I still couldn't put my finger on where the story is going, but I've definitely started hearing this part.
Yes. This was all very low-key. Uh-huh. Until the very end, when it ramped up very quickly.
Okay.
I'm going to circle back to Sarah here in a second, but moving past that, the cult members also included Martin Quintana, Jorge Montes, and Omar Oria. The group began to run a profitable business casting spells to bring good luck, which involved expensive ritual sacrifices of chickens, goats, snakes, zebras, and even lion cubs.
Zebras?
Zebras.
Where did they get those?
Well.
Okay, just tell me.
Many of his clients were rich drug dealers and hitmen.
Oh.
Who enjoyed the violence of Costanzo's magical displays. He also attracted other rich members of Mexican society, including several high-ranking corrupt policemen who introduced him to the city's powerful drug cartels. Costanzo started to raid graveyards for human bones to put in his nganga, or cauldron. Before long, his cult decided that the spirits of the dead that resided in the nganga would be stronger with live human sacrifices instead of old bones. So for clarity, let me give you a brief and very incomplete lesson in Palo religions and what a nganga is, because I'm a white bitch.
Uh-huh.
I do not have a seat at the table to speak on any of these because they're all closed religions, but just for informational purposes so we understand in the context of this story.
Okay.
The Palo religions are an African diasporic religion that developed in Cuba. It arose through a process of syncretism between the traditional Congo religion of Central Africa, the Roman Catholic form of Christianity, and Spiritism. Initiates in the religion are termed paleros or paleras, uh-huh, male or female. Palo teaches the existence of a creator deity. I'm not going to try and say the name. Who is uninvolved in human affairs. Central to Palo is the nganga or prenda. It's an iron cauldron into which human bones, sticks, and other items are placed. This is believed to be inhabited by the spirit of a dead individual who becomes the slave of the palero or palera. The practitioner commands the nganga to do their bidding, typically to heal, but also to cause harm. Those nganga primarily designed for benevolent acts are baptized, and those largely designed for malevolent acts are left unbaptized.
Okay.
The nganga is fed with the blood of sacrificed male animals. Various forms of divination are employed to determine messages from the spirits. So, this cult did some pretty sick shit in the name of Palo, but Palo is an old, beautiful, deeply spiritual collection of religions, and just because these yahoos made a mockery of it doesn't mean that the religion is evil. And if I hear anybody talking shit about these religions, I'm going to square the fuck up.
We're going to get mad about it.
We're going to get mad about it. So let's...
Okay. Understood.
Let's not act like people haven't been using like the good dang old Jesus Christ to justify toxic behavior for millennia.
Absolutely. Right? Well,
is it the Crusades? Westboro Baptist?
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of crazy wacko groups of people out there who use religion as a means to like act on their hateful thoughts.
Yeah. Conversion therapy.
Yeah.
The KKK.
It's all...
That is not religion. That is a cult.
Yes.
And that's how you draw the line.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's learn together, friends. Oh, God. I just... Sorry.
Welcome to Jenny and Taylor's Inclusion Corner. So after linking up with the big rollers in Mexico City, Constanzo began to believe that his magic spells, many of which he took from Palo Mayombe, were responsible for the success of the cartels and demanded to become a full business partner with one of the most powerful families he knew, the Calzadas. When his demand was rejected, 7 family members disappeared.
Oh, no.
Their bodies would turn up later with fingers, toes, ears, brains, and in one case... the spine missing.
Shut up. The spine?
No.
No, ma'am. Uh-uh. No.
What a spineless move.
I can't. No.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Constanzo soon made friends with a new cartel, the Hernandez brothers. So hold on to that name, put it in the memory banks.
Gonna need it for later.
I'm gonna need it. I'm gonna connect a couple dots for you real quick.
All right, great.
So Sarah Maria Aldrete Villarreal, told you I was gonna come back. See, trust the process. Was born in 1964.
Okay.
In a middle class in Matamoros, Tamaulipas, Mexico, near the border of the United States. She attended high school and later college across the river in Brownsville, Texas. At Brownsville, Texas Southmost College, Aldrete was a straight-A student and a cheerleader for the soccer team. She was also fascinated by the occult and knew people in the Mexican drug trade through Serafin Hernandez Garcia, who attended Texas Southmost with her and his uncle, Elio Hernandez Rivera, whom she dated, according to magazine Texas Monthly. The Hernandezes, I told you, I was going to come back and connecting dots. So the Hernandezes were members of a large family with relatives on either side of the border who made their money smuggling marijuana. Mexican authorities claimed that at the height of their power, they smuggled as much as 1 ton per week.
Oh my gosh.
And that their distribution network stretched from Mexico to Michigan.
Wow.
Presiding over this criminal enterprise was Saul Hernandez Rivera, Elio's older brother.
Okay.
Following his 1987 assassination, the family was beset by arrests and infighting. Elio emerged as the gang's new leader and turned to Constanzo for supernatural help and guidance. Aldrete took part in his initiation ceremony, according to the Los Angeles Times. Increasingly, the members of the Hernandez's gang fell under Constanzo's sway. He became their high priest and further enmeshed himself in their operations, performing ritualistic animal sacrifices that he claimed would help their business prosper and to protect them from police and bullets.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Constanzo and his followers eventually set up operations at Rancho Santa Elena. It's a property owned by the Hernandez family in Matamoros and less than a mile from the border. According to Constanzo, the greater the sacrifice, the greater the power it bestowed. Soon he was demanding human victims to offer up to the gods.
Oh, Lord.
The cult's first victims were rivals in the drug trade, members of other gangs, or corrupt cops who were brought back to the ranch where they were tortured and ritualistically slain.
Oh, no.
Body parts were put in the nganga and boiled, making a foul brew that cult members then drank, believing it made them invisible and bulletproof.
I don't think that that's how that works.
Mm. Some wore necklaces made from their victims' vertebrae.
Oh, God. So many spines.
So many spines. What is this? A chiropractor cult? So something.
That was bad.
I know. I know. I didn't even like it before I said it. Costanzo made Elio Hernandez an executioner priest, branding his chest and arms with sacred marks. Hernandez once ordered his henchmen to bring him the first male they could find for sacrifice. It was only after lopping off his hooded victim's head with a machete that he realized he had killed one of his own nephews. We're going to blaze on. I know, it's a lot to absorb. In early March 1989, Costanzo ordered his followers to bring him an Anglo male for his next human sacrifice. According to Salt Lake City Deseret News, he believed this offering would grant even greater supernatural powers to himself and his followers. Mark James Kilroy of Santa Fe, Texas, would fit most people's idea of the all-American male. Tall and athletic, blonde hair, attended the University of Texas in Austin, where he was studying to become a doctor.
Oh, wow.
When classes let out on March 10th, 1989, Kilroy and three friends traveled to South Padre Island, Texas, for spring break. They planned to spend their days at the beach and their nights partying south of the border. Kilroy had just turned 21.
Oh, my gosh.
In the early morning hours of March 14th, cult members snatched Kilroy off of a side street in Matamoros where he had been bar hopping. He was taken back to the ranch, tortured, sodomized, and then slain by Costanzo with a machete chop to the back of his head. His brain and spinal column were then removed for ritual use, and his body was dismembered for easy burial. Unfortunately for Costanzo and his followers, they could not have picked a worse victim.
Oh.
Kilroy's uncle was a special agent with the U.S. Customs Service, and within days, his disappearance was reported by UPI and investigated by multiple law enforcement agencies from both countries.
Picked the wrong dude.
You picked the wrong dude. Believing himself to be invisible from the gross blood soup, Serafin Hernandez Garcia drove past a police roadblock on Matamoros on April 1st.
Does he think it makes his car also invisible?
That's what I was thinking. What is this, like Mermaid Man and Barnacle Boy? The invisible crabmobile or whatever they drive?
I have no idea any of the words you just said. Okay.
What? They're invisible. I don't know.
Who?
Mermaid Man and Barnacle Boy.
Babe, I do not know what that is.
What?
No.
How? Oh, God. They're from SpongeBob.
Oh, that would be why.
Okay.
I did not watch SpongeBob.
I know. I still enjoy a good SpongeBob reference every once in a blue moon. So, yes, he thought he was invisible. He just thought that, like, I don't think they physically thought that they were invisible. I thought that it was more like they were flying under the radar and, like, the police couldn't
discern that they had anything to do with it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Interesting.
Authorities chased him down after he drove past the roadblock, and he led them straight back to Ranchero Santa Elena, the ranch.
Uh-oh.
They just followed him
back.
An initial search of the property turned up 65 pounds of marijuana in a ritual shed which contained Costanzo's and ganga. Mexican police allegedly refused to continue the investigation until a healer known as a curandero came and purified the site and cast out any evil spirits.
Okay.
A caretaker on the property said he recognized Kilroy from a photograph police showed him. His body was exhumed along with 14 others, according to Oklahoma's Tulsa World newspaper.
You got newspapers from all over the place.
I know. You got lots of sources. Police, which I love this, they forced members of the gang to help dig up the bodies.
Good!
Put some manual labor in there. Yeah,
you know where they all are.
Right. You put them in there, but that is also, like, there's question as to how many victims there were.
Okay.
Because they just dug them up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's not like they went out and searched
the entire
ranch for more.
They had all been dismembered, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure there were more.
Yes, we're sure. And, like, that grand total, so that's 15 total,
okay,
with Kilroy, the 14 other victims. Uh-huh. That doesn't include the seven members of the first cartel who refused to work with him because that wasn't like the cult.
Okay. That was just gang related killing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right. So by April 13th, Elio and Serafin Hernandez and two other gang members had been arrested and confessed to multiple murders. Their high priest and his closest confidants, however, evaded capture for another month. Mexican police eventually tracked Constanzo Aldrete and several other cult members to an apartment building in Mexico City. On May 6, 1989, Constanzo spotted a police car outside the building, picked up a machine gun, and began firing.
Oh, jeez.
He grabbed a bundle of money and threw it and began shooting out the window.
Wait, he grabbed a bundle of money?
He grabbed a bundle of money
and
threw it out the window at the police. I don't know. What kind of weird macho move is that? I don't know.
All I can think of is in Sleeping Beauty when Maleficent is, what is it? It's arrows, poison arrows or something, and the fairy godmothers make it butterflies.
Yes.
That's all I can think of is bullets turning into money.
I just imagine a Cardi B music video with, like, the gun that shoots out singles.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's what I imagine.
I see.
So Alvaro de Leon Valdez, who was a cult member who was in the apartment with them while this was happening, after he was captured, told the New York Times that Constanzo was like, everything is lost. Everything we've worked for is gone, and this is the end. And following a 45-minute gun battle, Constanzo ordered de Leon Valdez to shoot him and his lover, Martin Quintana Rodriguez, rather than let them be captured alive, and he did as he was told and riddled them with machine gun fire.
Wow.
Aldrete was apprehended as she tried to flee the apartment. She said that he told everybody, let's all die. We need to die together, but she didn't want to. And in May 1994, Sarah Aldrete was sentenced to 62 years in prison.
Damn. Which
does not seem like enough time.
No.
For 15 bodies. At the same time, Elio and Serafin Hernandez and two other cult members were sentenced to 67 years in prison, which was reduced to a 50-year sentence in 1998.
Why are we reducing sentences?
I don't know. But that is the story of the narco-Satanists, otherwise known as the Matamoros cult.
Wow.
There are gnarly photographs.
Are there?
Yeah.
Oh, I bet.
There's videos on YouTube.
Shut up.
Yeah. It's, yeah.
Wow.
Not for
the faint of heart.
Not for the faint of heart or stomach.
Yeah. Ooh.
So.
Rough.
Rough indeed.
Hey, I'm Jeanette.
And I'm Emily.
We are from Horror Slumber Party Podcast.
We make episodes all about true crime, but also paranormal activity.
We try to post at least once a week.
And we try to make everybody feel as comfortable as possible.
Just like you're at a slumber party listening to ghost stories.
You can find us on any podcast platform just by looking up Horror Slumber Party.
Good night and scary dreams.
Bye.
But not as rough as... Taylor's book report.
My book report today is going to be two parts, as Jenny alluded to earlier, because I am doing the Branch Davidians and the Siege of Waco.
Mm.
So I will be doing the cult today, and then next week, tune back in to hear about the disaster.
Which was an actual fucking disaster.
An actual disaster. And part of the reason why I wanted to do two parts on this was because... most people know about all of the, maybe not all, but most of the things that happened in the siege, but not everybody knows about the cult stuff, the stuff that happened before the siege.
Right.
So I really wanted to dedicate time to that and all the things that led to the siege. Do you need a pillow? Do you need a blanket?
Oh, no, I'm good.
Okay, excellent. Woof. Okay.
Woof indeed.
Cults are normally pretty cut and dry. An evil, charismatic leader brainwashes masses of people and forces them to do things they would not normally do. Charismatic leader gets caught and is arrested. That is the story that we know fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
But our justice is unfortunately not as black and white in this case with the Branch Davidians from Waco, Texas. The story actually begins in the mid-1900s with a man named Victor Houtef, or Houtef. Houtef was a Bulgarian immigrant and a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. However, in the early 1920s, he wrote a differing viewpoint on the teachings of the Seventh-day Adventists entitled The Shepherd's Rod, and it called for reform of the SDA Church.
I don't like Shepherd's Rod.
Oh, there's a few times we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
And I also don't like it.
Okay. It sounds icky.
It sounds oddly sexual for a purist cult.
You know, you think that they would avoid words like rod.
You would think. I mean, in all things with cults, though, it is very much the idea of we're pure, we... our bodies are temples, blah, 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 but everybody is banging.
Oh, yeah.
Left, right, and center.
Yeah.
Okay, so the short version is that the church said no thank you to the shepherd's rod, and Houtef took about 50 people who did agree with him out of the church. The group casually referred to as the Rod built Mount Carmel, a rural community and headquarters near Waco, Texas. It gets culty right off the bat here, and we aren't even to the story that we know in the 1990s. Houtef had completed authority over the community, and his followers believed that he was the only person who could reveal biblical secrets about the end of time. In 1932, at age 52, Houtef married Florence Hermanen, a 17-year-old daughter of two of his followers.
Yikes.
Yeah. Houtef told his followers that he could not die, but he would lead his people to Old Jerusalem and therefore to heavenly Canaan. However...
What is that? Paradise? Is that like heaven?
I think so.
Okay.
However, Houtef suddenly died due to heart failure in 1955.
Oh, well, don't you think?
And left all of his followers completely shocked and confused.
Well, yeah.
He's been spouting off about how he can't die.
Don't you think that would like just... The cult would just disband itself.
You would think. There are so many instances of this.
Okay.
Okay. The loss of their leader led to instability within the church organization leadership.
No shit.
Along with the formation of several splinter groups. Prior to his death, Houtef had appointed his wife Florence to lead until God chose another prophet. And while she was in charge, Florence sold the land and purchased a new parcel of land just 9 miles east of Waco, Texas. They called this new area New Mount Carmel.
Mm-hmm.
Florence predicted the imminent establishment of God's kingdom on precisely April 22nd, 1959.
Oh.
They called on members to gather at New Mount Carmel to see this new kingdom, and people started gathering there in March for this April 22nd event. About 900 people gathered, but when signs did not appear, the Davidians began to disperse quickly.
Yeah.
However, during these gatherings, Benjamin Rodin announced that he was the sign the Davidians were seeking.
Convenient.
Yeah.
He's been here all along.
He said that he was the branch mentioned in Zechariah 3:8 and in 6:12. Rodin called the Davidians to get off the dead rod and move to the living branch.
No. How many dick innuendos can you fit in one cult?
Too many. Oh my God. Okay, so we've got Florence and we have Benjamin Rodin so far.
Okay, and he's the branch.
Yes.
Okay.
Rodin took possession of New Mount Carmel in 1962. On February 27th, 1973, New Mount Carmel was sold to Benjamin Rodin, Lois Rodin, and their son George Rodin, trustees of the General Association of Branch Davidian Seventh-day Adventists.
It's so long.
Yes. So now we need to remember George Rodin. Okay. He's next.
Okay.
Rodin insisted that his followers led a more pure lifestyle and spouted promises that if they did, Christ would return soon after the members reached a state of moral maturity.
Ew.
Rodin died in 1978.
I'm so sorry. That's awful.
They just keep dying.
Well, this should have been... Spoiler alert.
Yeah. It's... Circle of life. Homies. Jesus. At first, his members were torn between following his wife, Lois, or their son, George. And I'm not sure if they had differing viewpoints or what the issue was there and, like, why they were at odds.
Yeah.
But Lois had converted a young man named Vernon Howell, who is...
Vernon!
Who is charismatic and faithful. So let's get into Vernon here a little bit, because he is our main character. Vernon Howell was born August 17th, 1959 in Houston, Texas, to a 14-year-old single mother named Bonnie Sue Clark.
That is young.
Yeah. And father Bobby Wayne Howell. Before Howell was born, his father met another teenage girl and abandoned Bonnie Sue, who began cohabitating with a violent alcoholic. Yeah. In 1963, Howell's mother left with her boyfriend and placed her 4-year-old son in the care of his maternal grandmother, Earlene Clark. His mother returned when he was 7 after her marriage to a carpenter named Roy Haldeman. And Howell described his early childhood as very lonely. Due to his poor study skills and dyslexia, he was put in special education classes and he dropped out of Garland High School in his junior year. When he was 19 years old, he claimed to have become a born-again Christian in the Southern Baptist Church and soon joined his mother's denomination, the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Mm. There, Hal became infatuated with the pastor's daughter, and while praying for guidance, he opened his eyes and allegedly found the Bible opened at Isaiah 34:16, stating that, and I quote, "None should want for her mate." Convinced that this was a sign from God, Howell approached the pastor and told him that God wanted him to have his daughter for a wife. The pastor threw him out. And when he continued to persist with the pursuit of his daughter, he was expelled from the congregation.
Dang!
However,
oh.
Howell had already had a sexual relationship with the girl, who was 15 years old, and she became pregnant.
Oh my gosh.
In 1983, so let's go back to Mount Carmel.
Okay.
Lois allowed Howell to begin teaching his own message called the Serpent's Root. Which caused controversy in the group.
Yeah, I bet it sure did.
Lois died in 1986 and her son took control, so George. But there was a massive power struggle between George and Vernon Howell.
Okay.
George Roden, claiming to have the support of the majority of the cult, forced Howell and his group off the property at gunpoint.
Oh my God.
Yes. Howell and around 25 followers set up camp at Palestine, Texas, 90 miles from Waco, where they lived under really super horrible rough conditions. Like they lived in tents and in buses for 2 years.
Why? Because
they didn't have anywhere to go.
Oh my God.
They had no money. They don't work. They just live off the land.
It's so like a refugee camp of their own making.
Yes. Yeah. Tents and school buses that they were able to, I don't know if they purchased or sold them, what happened, but they had school buses.
Okay.
During this time, Hal undertook recruitment of new followers in California, the UK, Israel, and Australia. That same year, he traveled to Israel, where he claimed he had a vision that he was the modern day Cyrus.
Oh.
George Roden renamed Mount Carmel Rodenville during this time. But Vernon Howell still had his eyes set on being the leader of the whole group, not just this handful of people. In an attempt to prove who was better suited for the job of leader, George decided to challenge Vernon Howell to a religious zealot duel of sorts.
Did you say duel of sorts or duel of swords?
Of sorts. Happy Cat, don't do that.
What are they gonna do? Quote the Bible at each other?
Oh, I wish. I wish that that's all that they did.
What did they do?
They dug up a body.
What?
And George said that whoever could raise her from the dead could be the leader.
Whose body?
It was a 20... a woman who had been a Davidian. She'd been dead for 20 years.
Ew.
Yeah.
So they dug up some musty, crusty bones?
Yeah. And said, raise her from the dead.
Okay, but spoiler alert. You can't. She dead.
She's dead.
Dumb been dead. She'd been dead for a minute.
You're not even creating a situation that anybody could win.
She's deader than a doornail, bud. She's toast.
We might as well have a duel of swords.
At least somebody's gonna win.
There's a for sure outcome.
Yeah.
Old girl's been hitting the sheets with Jesus for about 2 decades.
She's like, please leave me alone. I'm happy here.
Please leave me back in the cold, dark earth.
Where I'm meant to be.
Please.
So even though David might not, or I'm sorry, even though Vernon Howell might not have been the brightest of the bunch, he wasn't stupid. He knew that tampering with corpse was illegal. So he just called the police. So he rang them up and said, hey guys, I know a guy who has a dead body.
Done dang up a dead body.
And the police told him that they needed proof. So on November 3rd, 1987, Vernon and his followers raided Mount Carmel to get proof of this dead body. They were equipped with 5 semi-automatic rifles, 2 22 caliber rifles, 2 12 gauge rifles, and nearly 400 rounds of ammunition.
Okay, do you know how expensive that is, though? How are y'all living in tents and school buses?
And have weaponry like that?
Yeah.
That's a great question. I have no idea.
I would reevaluate.
I wonder if it had something to do with them being pure. Like, what? Not, like, living...
Oh.
In a way that could be like with another society? I don't know. What did you
I didn't know where
where I was going.
I couldn't follow the brain noodle from point A to point B.
How dare you not be able to follow my brain noodle?
I know, I'm sorry. You got squirrely. Squirrely brain noodles.
It's a very apt description.
Yeah.
Okay. Although Vernon and his pals claimed that they were trying to obtain evidence of George's illegal activities, no one took a camera with them to capture this proof that they were supposedly after.
Remember when you said he wasn't dumb?
Yeah.
I disagree.
I also disagree with my own statements and brain noodles.
Got it.
The trail ended with... Oh, I'm sorry. They ended up all getting arrested and going to jail. All of them. And the trial ended with the jury finding Vernon's followers not guilty. After the trial, Vernon invited the prosecutor to Mount Carmel for ice cream.
Cute.
Like, no harm, no foul, my dude.
Want to come have a sundae?
Come get a banana split.
Banana lickety split, my dude.
So one of the first things Hal did after taking spiritual leadership, I think I forgot to mention that Vernon and his followers were found not guilty, but all of George and his dudes did go to jail for having a dead body.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, because...
Well, don't dig up a dead body!
There was a standoff, obviously, with all of these weapons, yeah. And the police did get involved at that point. Okay. And they found...
The dead body.
The dead body.
Okay.
So, Georgie...
It was a windy road, but boy, did we get there.
Yeah. Yeah, George went to jail for okay. that.
Well, Georgie...
And then later, he went to a mental institution after that, so.
Was it because he was crazy and he thought he could bring a dead body back to life?
I would imagine that did, in fact, have something to do with that.
Certainly a contributing factor.
Yes.
If not the entire it was diagnosis.
Not overlooked.
Thoroughly evaluated.
So now Hal has leadership of the group, just like he always wanted.
So happy for him.
And the first thing he does is adopt a new name. And this is when we know him as David Koresh.
Okay, what? He didn't want to go by Vern?
Vernie?
Vernie boy?
Yeah, he changed it. And now is David Koresh forever and ever.
Koresh?
Koresh.
Koresh.
K-O-R-E-S-H.
Okay. I would pick an easier last name, but that's just me. And not my cult, not my problem.
Has to do, it is... I think it is a pronunciation or the original pronunciation of Cyrus.
Ah.
Where he went to Israel and they said, like, he is the modern day Cyrus. So David okay. is, like, in our...
I'm not trying to be this way.
Okay.
And uh-huh. I'm sorry if this is what gets us canceled.
Oh, God.
But why are we all so obsessed with Israel?
That was never something that I was taught in my years and years of, like, religion.
Yeah.
I was never taught, like, we have to go to Israel, like, we have to go, like, I don't know. Is it just because it's the...
Place?
Birthplace?
Is it the birthplace?
I don't know.
I don't know either. How Somebody was I? Who I has was so their deeply
in religion, let us know.
I don't, my mom always had, well, our church was called Calvary Temple, which I think is the, Calvary is the hill that Jesus was crucified on. And I think that was in Israel.
Oh, okay.
Wasn't there a rock, a cave? I don't know. I don't get it. But like, know. Even today, like, it is mm-hmm. such like a war-torn nation because there's so many people who all think that Israel is theirs.
Yeah. I don't know. Good, great questions.
Okay.
Don't have the answers.
I'm sorry. I'm just uneducated.
I also, I'm not going to act like I have any idea about why that is.
Okay.
So, anywho, in true creepy cult fashion, he began to take spiritual wives from the group's unmarried members.
You know, as soon as they start bringing in spiritual wives,
we're in trouble.
Yeah.
It's not good. Koresh identified himself as the prophet God of God and Messiah. Because of that, any children born of the Messiah would be sacred.
Great.
Some of the women he took as spiritual wives were underage, and he fathered at least 13 children.
God almighty.
At least.
Can you imagine if, like, you're holed up with your husband, and he's, like, on Tinder, like, swiping right on people, and he's like, don't worry, babe, they're just my spiritual wives.
God wants like, this.
I'm about to make you a spirit if you don't put the phone down.
Truly. So he had one legal wife. Her name was Rachel Jones. And Rachel was as dedicated to this idea as David was.
Okay.
So she was very much one of the women that the girls would go to and be like, I don't know, I'm scared. And she would be like, this is God's will. This is what God wants. And
meanwhile, God's like, leave me out of it.
Yeah. No. Oh,
this ain't the way.
Yeah. In 1989, he asserted that he was the perfect mate for all female members, all married and unmarried, and confided to the Davidians his intention to create a new lineage of children who he believed would eventually rule the world. His doctrine of the House of David led to marriages with both married and single women in the branch Davidians. This doctrine was based on a revelation that involved the procreation of 24 children by chosen women in the community. These 24 children were to serve as the ruling elders in Revelation 4 over the millennium after the return of Christ.
Okay.
So he was trying to build
a high council?
Yeah.
Okay. Listen, I gotta tell, I'm Googling him right now. He's not even cute.
No.
It's a big old mullet, but I can't.
Not my type.
No. Vern.
Of course, Koresh was obsessed with the Book of Revelation. Yada, yada, yada. We all know that. All cult leaders in the Book of Revelation. It's a thing. He thought he was the lamb mentioned in Revelation 5, and he believed the lamb's role was to break the seven seals and to interpret the scroll mentioned in Revelation 5:2, thereby bringing forth the end time revelation of Christ.
Oh my God.
Yeah. God also happened to mention something else to Koresh.
Of course he did.
Clive Doyle, a survivor, recalls Koresh saying that they should start building an army for God because one day the world would end and all non-believers would be cut off from heaven. So they began ordering weapons and preparing for the end of days. So that is when other people in the community and authorities really start putting their eyeballs.
Because they're like, why does this Jesus cult need so many guns?
So many weapons. So many. In 1992, an ex-branch Davidian named David Jewell filed a custody suit for his daughter, Curie. Curie and her mother, Sherry, were both still in the cult, and Jewell had learned that 12-year-old Curie was in line to be one of David Koresh's brides.
Uh-oh.
So he freaked out.
Yeah. Well, it's a grown-ass dude trying to marry your 12-year-old.
Right.
Yeah.
So this accusation of child abuse was one of the first that brought the FBI's attention. In addition, a six-month investigation of sexual abuse allegations by Texas Child Protective Services in 1992 failed to turn up any evidence, possibly because the branch Davidians concealed the spiritual marriage of Koresh to Michelle Jones. Michelle Jones was the younger sister of his legal wife, Rachel.
Ooh.
They assigned a surrogate husband, David Thibodeau, to the girl for the sake of appearances.
Oh my God.
Right. Regarding the allegations of physical abuse, the evidence is less certain.
In one widely reported incident, ex-members claimed that Koresh became irritated with the cries of his son Cyrus and spanked the child severely for several minutes on three consecutive visits to the child's bedroom. In a second report, a man involved with a custody battle, I think that is referring to Jewel, mm-hmm. visited the Mount Carmel Center and claimed to have seen the beating of a young boy with a stick.
Ooh.
On February 27th, 1993, the Waco Tribune Herald began publishing The Sinful Messiah, a series of articles by Mark England and Darlene McCormick, who reported allegations that Koresh had physically abused children in the compound and had committed statutory rape by taking multiple underage brides.
Yep.
So that was a huge tipping point. Now the world knows what's happening.
Whistleblower.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, to be an investigative journalist.
Oh, yeah.
Just to be one. In addition to allegations of sexual abuse and misconduct, Koresh and his followers were suspected of stockpiling illegal weapons. In May of 1992, a UPS driver called the chief deputy of the McLennan County Sheriff's Department to report a concern. The driver had said a package had broken open on delivery to the Branch Davidian residence, revealing firearms, grenade casings, and black powder.
Yikes.
Not good.
That's concerning.
Yeah.
Don't you think if you're a delivery driver, you should be informed if, like, you're carrying bombs and shit?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think that's part of what made it, like, illegal. They didn't want anybody to know what they were having, what they had in their arsenal.
How do you not know if you're shipping grenades? How? How do you not know?
Like, how does UPS not know?
Like, anybody. How? Where do they get it from? Who are they ordering? Is there a Sears catalog? This is, what, the 80s? What are we doing?
That's a great question. I don't know. There's not the internet.
Right. There's no back page. There's no black web.
There's not even credit cards at this point. You can't even give payment over the phone.
Huh?
Right? Isn't it just cash?
I think they had credit cards.
Did they? I might be.
I'm going to Google it.
Okay, you.
This is about to make a sound. Uneducated.
That's not that different for us.
Did credit cards be invented? What? Wait. The grammatical errors. Okay, continue.
Okay. The chief deputy went ahead and gave the folks at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the ATF, a call to notify them. Within the month, the ATF opened a formal investigation. On July 30th, two ATF agents visited the Branch Davidian's gun dealer, Henry McMowen, and tried to get them to talk with Koresh on the phone. Koresh offered to let the ATF inspect the Branch Davidian's weapons and paperwork. He was like, come on in. The ATF set up a surveillance house across the road from the compound. And this was not well thought out. They are in the middle of nowhere. This compound is in the middle of nowhere. Nobody's lived in this house for ages. And suddenly it's just occupied.
Hmm.
And it was two guys in their 30s. And when one of the people from the compound came over to introduce themselves and say hello and be neighborly, kind of, they said that they were college students. But they never left at the same time. They were, most of the time they were at the house. They had nice cars.
Okay, we couldn't, that's a little sus.
It was not a great cover.
Okay. Not trying super hard.
Right. But one of the agents, Robert Rodriguez, actually went across and got to know the members. So he was invited to Bible studies. He was starting to kind of become a member of the community, but not in a like culty way. He was just invited to a lot of stuff.
Okay.
And one of the things that becomes really controversial now is that there are a lot of survivors who to this day say that this was not a cult. This was a religious place, and they were just good people. They were neighborly. They wanted to invite people. There wasn't this rule that you couldn't leave. People left all the time.
Okay.
So the thing that I personally get stuck on is I can see it from that point of view until I start thinking about the spiritual brides, the child
having
rape,
having sex with children.
Yeah. That part is not okay.
No. There will never be any God worth worshiping
that
will say
yes.
Yes.
I agree 100%. So I will leave you with a quote And then we will get into the disaster portion next week.
Oh my God, oh my God.
As Gary Cartwright wrote, for 9 years, Koresh had relentlessly drilled his followers to prepare for the Armageddon, had preached its inevitability, had forecasted its imminence. This was the ending that Koresh had prayed for and staked his reputation on, a final battle, a trial by fire. It didn't matter if the fire came from automatic rifles or a match and a can of kerosene. This was what Koresh had promised. Anything less would have been a monumental betrayal of his claim to be David Koresh, angel warrior of the Armageddon. Did anyone really expect the prophet of Ranch Apocalypse to meekly surrender his sheep to the enemy and come out with his hands up? No, I don't think so. My sources were Britannica, Vox.com, The New York Times, Waco Tribune Herald, and Zealot Podcast.
God. Ew.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm really nervous about next week.
It's not good.
Okay.
Just a heads up, it is a 52-day siege.
52? See, days. I don't know. I know people always talk about Waco, and I knew it was in Texas.
Okay.
And that is the end of my knowledge about Waco.
It's fascinating because there were so many people who were wrong.
Wrong?
Yes. Nobody got it right. The ATF didn't get it right. The FBI didn't get it right. The Branch Davidians didn't get it right. Everybody had their pride in the game. And so everybody made really horrible decisions that ended up with lives lost over the next 52 days.
Oh, God.
And... there's a lot of trials that we'll get into, kind of who was responsible and where it ended. And it was one of the very first, I think, disasters that made national headlines and was also televised live.
Oh.
Because it was 1993.
Okay.
And I guess it was, I mean, it's not the first televised disaster, but it was a really big deal.
Yeah.
Everybody stopped what they were doing. And where I was paying attention to this.
Yeah.
And they knew what was going on.
It's like media sensationalized.
Yes. Yeah. Got it.
Fun fact, the first plastic credit card was released in 1959.
Oh, okay. So we had credit cards back then.
We had credit cards. Yes.
I'm sorry. I am stupid.
No, you're not.
You're not. I don't know anything.
We just, listen, our brains are full of other more interesting information, like... bury a body underneath an endangered plant so nobody can dig it up. That's actually really terrible advice.
Right. I was thinking the other day that there are a lot of things that I know nothing about, but every story that we do, we basically become a semi-expert in that topic.
That's a bold claim.
No, okay.
I don't retain the information.
Really?
Oh my God.
You
no.
just write it and then it's gone?
I can't. Yes. My brain... Listen, my brain soup bowl is only so big. And sometimes we let go of math and sometimes we let go of old episodes.
I see. Okay. That makes sense.
I'll have like some of our mutual friends who like listen.
Uh-huh.
Will listen to like a podcast and then I don't see them for like 6 to 8 weeks later and they're like, "Oh my gosh, and you were talking about da 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 da," and I was like, "What is that?"
Oh my God.
I don't know what that is. I'm sorry.
I get the some people will just text me like a dumb thing that we said.
Oh gosh.
And oh gosh, I was like, sounds like us.
Yeah, that sounds
right. I don't know when that was or who said it, but
I believe it was said.
Sounds right.
Sounds just dumb enough for it to have happened.
Right. Oh Lord. So what's your bright and shiny today?
My bright and shiny today is that, hold on, how do I say this without sounding stupid? So we're recording this on Mother's Day.
Yes.
And I am just feeling really thankful for all of the mothers that not like people who have mothered me, although them too, which also includes you. Happy Mother's Day to Taylor, who spent a lot of our early 20s
momming Jenny around.
Momming the shit out of me. But just the act of like women and mothering the things that they care about, I just is like such a really beautiful thing that I think people too often stress the relationship between like a mother and a child, not like the actual nurturing and loving and caring for whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
So that is my bright and shiny. Oh, just women. Nice. You know when you look at women and you're like, oh, women.
Yes.
That. Yeah. Women are my bright and shiny.
I am here for that. Yeah. I would also second that bright and shiny. The idea that people can just unconsciously adopt people and be like, you are now mine. You're now my human.
Yes.
I'm going to take care of you. Or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's just really, really sweet and nice. And I also realized that in our 30s now, we are surrounded with our friends who are now mothers.
Yes.
And that has been a wild change.
It's an adjustment.
Yeah. Because now I'm like, I have so many mothers in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And they all deserve so much gratitude and so much celebration. And they don't get that. They should get it every day.
Yeah.
But I think this is a really good opportunity for us as friends to support our mother friends.
Yes.
Because now I think we see how hard it is and how much struggle it is to be a mom.
Mm-hmm.
And as two people who have never given birth to our own children.
Nope.
I just really respect women who are capable of having that much love in their heart.
Oh my God. I just can't even speak. It's a miracle that women don't eat their young, you know?
they don't reject their young like kittens.
Yes, I really.
Yeah.
It's amazing. All for the people who have actually like made the tiny humans.
Yeah.
Bro. I feel like the government should be. It's wild. So mothers.
Yeah.
Whether that's to a person or an aloe plant or yourself.
Aw, mothering yourself. Well, sometimes we had to learn how to do that really young, and that sucks.
Yeah.
But.
It does suck. But that's my bright and shiny. What's yours?
What's yours? Let me think. I got to go have kind of just a Mother's Day day with my grandma and my aunt yesterday and my cousins. And we went to a winery and it was really nice to see them. And I've just been wanting to spend as much time with my grandparents as I can because they are getting older. And it's not going to be forever that they'll be here. So just kind of hearing their stories and getting to talk to them more as people.
Because
as a child, you don't talk to your grandparents like that.
Like people. They're just your grandparents.
Right. So getting to spend time with them like that has been really nice.
Yeah.
And my grandpa has the most morbid sense of humor. And I think I might have gotten this from him because at Easter, he came up to me and my little sister and was like, you want to see the condo I bought? And I was like, immediately suspicious.
Sure.
Claire goes, oh, a condo?
Of course she did.
And my grandpa decided then was a great time to show us the headstone that he had purchased. And then was mad that I didn't look through all of the photos of him standing next to his headstone.
I love that.
I
have a picture of mom with her headstone.
Why?
I don't. She wanted it.
It's the weirdest. It's the weirdest thing.
It's a weird thing.
I am so happy that this brings them joy. But
I would like, if I'm, don't ever bury me.
No.
But like, if I were to be buried, I would like a picture of me with my tombstone, then put on the tombstone.
Oh, just like a never ending, like
yes.
A babushka doll of pictures.
It's the Russian nesting doll of grave sites. Yes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I was just very happy to spend time with my grandma and my aunts and just chilling.
You know,
yesterday it was nice.
Love your family. You just don't ever know.
Yeah.
So
that's my bright and shiny. Go hug your moms for us. They deserve it.
Go give any mother that you know love. And if you're a mom, give yourself love too. That is the most important.
Yeah. And know that Jenny and I love you
so much.
Take care of yourself.
And others. Are we changing the sign off?
I think I started it. Normally I finish it.
Yeah.
Do you want to do it again?
Yeah, be kind to yourself.
And to others.
Okay. Goodbye.